Okay, so we have just been looking at the problems with the sensual world and the five senses and all the objects in that world. And there's one more simile to go, but I'll pass that by for now because it's a little bit, I think it's better to have a look at the next sutta and do that in full rather than mix things up too much. We'll come back to that simile later on, but I think for now we'll just leave it to one side. So we're looking at some of the most important problems as far as the mind is concerned, how to change your outlook a little bit, how to deal with the mental things. And one of the most important things to deal with on the Buddhist path is ill will or anger and upset and all of these kind of things. And to kind of to reduce that. There's a number of reasons why that is so important. One of the reasons is because the Buddha says ill will is very blameworthy, sensuality much less blameworthy, and blameworthy in terms of, I guess, how we affect others and what kind of karma it leads to, and that sort of thing, and how it detracts from the spiritual path and all of these kind of things. It is very blameworthy, but also importantly, it is relatively easy to deal with. Sensuality is a much more deep-rooted problem. Ill will is relatively easy. And this is why it is so important to do something with this. And this is one of the main suttas that talks about this. So very useful and very comes to the very kind of core of what dealing with the mind is all about and how to kind of make progress on the path in a little bit deeper sense than just being moral in an ordinary sense of the word. So this sutta is called the Agata Pativinaya Sutta. In the numerical discourses, the 5 is number 162. So let's just get into it and see what happens. One of the suttas I read out on every retreat because it's so important to be reminded of this and just to get these kind of very useful techniques on how to overcome these things, how to actually just to be reminded of those things once again. So there the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus. Friends bhikkhus, friend those bhikkhus replied, and the Venerable Sariputta said this: friends, there are these 5 ways of removing resentment, in other words, ill will or whatever, by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. What 5? Here a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. Or a person's verbal behavior is impure, but their bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time they gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and they do not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time begin an opening of the mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So here you have 5 categories of people. And in case you didn't follow the sequence closely, that sequence covers all people, all beings, all people are included in that. There's no one who kind of falls outside. So if you have your favorite person to have resentment towards, I'm sorry, but there is no room for kind of leaving anyone outside. That's good news, isn't it? It's great that actually there's a method for dealing with everyone. There isn't like any, your favorite object of kind of ill will, you can't even leave those out. But actually it's very good news, because it means that we have to deal with things fully. We can't allow ourselves to leave everyone outside. If you're going to practice this path properly, you can't really afford to have ill will towards anyone. Of course, occasionally ill will arising, that's not the issue, but you can't afford to like have enemies, people that you have a permanently bad relationship to. Whatever other people have against you, that's none of our business. We can't do anything about that. But how we deal with others, we can always do something about. So, and these kind of this sort of idea becomes very clear when you do the death contemplation, that you can't have, you know, enemies, because if you're going to die, how can you go around having enemies? It would feel terrible to die with all of these enemies in your heart. This is why we need to clear it up straight away. There's only one time to clear these things up, and that's now. And to sort it out and to ensure that we look at things in a different way. So everyone is included in this list of five. And the listing, the reason there are five categories, we'll see in a second, is because the way to deal with them is slightly different depending on the kind of person they are. So for that reason, there's five. The first two are very similar. The first two are pretty much the same, but the rest of them are slightly different. And that's why they're dealt with in different ways. So let's just get on to this. So the first kind of person, how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robed bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spit it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion, you should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here, what we have here, you distinguish a person into many into different qualities, and you realize that people are complex. They have some good qualities, some bad qualities, perhaps some neutral qualities. They don't really matter so much, but some good and some bad. And most people are a bit like that. We can see both good qualities in them and bad qualities in them. It's very rare to find pretty rare to find someone who is all bad, and equally rare to find someone who's all good. Most people are somewhere in between. So the point of this here is to build up that perception of the good qualities and sort of leave the bad qualities by the way, so don't worry about those. Either forgive them or just not focus on them at all, and then build up the perception of the good qualities. This is not so difficult to do. It depends on the person. If you take, for example, a group of good people, let's take everyone who is here at Jhana Grove, now, and just all you have to do is just remind yourself that the good qualities in this case are far greater than any bad qualities. At the very least, everyone here is trying their very best, and they are kind of moving in the right direction, and that is worthy of so much respect that someone is even trying to live well. What a wonderful thing that is. So you just remind yourself of the fact that people are at least trying and they are heading in the right direction. Often they have lots of good qualities. I know so many of you who are on this retreat, and I know how many good qualities are there. And what a wonderful thing it is to celebrate that. So you remind yourself of that. And sometimes in the heat of the moment, when kind of little irritations happen, we forget about the big picture. So you build up that big picture in your mind's eye. You remind yourself again and again of those good qualities, especially if it is someone you have a bit of trouble with. I don't know, maybe someone on the committee, for example. Committees are notoriously difficult. And I feel really sorry for those people who have to work on the committee sometimes, because it is hard. And sometimes on those committees, you have to kind of use that perception to remind yourself of the good qualities of the people you are working with. Otherwise, you can get dragged down by differences of opinion and all this kind of stuff. So you build that up on your little shelf in your mind. You build up this perception of the good qualities. And then when problems arise, you pull down that good, positive perception. And as soon as you drag it down, it's like it destroys the negative perception. And this is what I was talking about before when we're talking about using wisdom power rather than willpower. I said that wisdom power actually has the ability to abolish the opposing quality completely. It doesn't just suppress it or hold it down, but it abolishes it. It obliterates it. It makes it non-existent. Anabhavangameti goes to non-existence, like obliteration, basically. So this is the power of wisdom, is that when you see the positive quality here, and you can let go of the negative one because that it actually obliterates it completely, and then you have a positive perception here. And there is very little energy or willpower involved. All you have to do is a little bit of turn your mind in the right direction, and that turning of the mind in the right direction, that is the right effort. The right effort is to build up that quality in your mind and then turn your mind in the right direction after that. So it has that double benefit I was mentioning before. It doesn't take so much energy. You don't feel exhausted by suppressing it all the time. It's a fairly simple thing, and it is incredibly powerful at the same time. So that is how it works. So remember that. This is something that you can do in many parts of life, in many people, because many people fall into this category. And it is especially useful to use with people who are practicing the spiritual path with you, because you know that there's lots of good qualities there. Okay, so let's have a look at the simile that the Buddha, or the Venerable Sariputta, has used here. So this simile is about the rag-robed bhikkhu. A rag robe is a robe where you find the material for the robe, you find it in various places. Yeah, you wander around, you see a bit of cloth here, a bit of cloth there, you pick it up from the ground, and then you kind of take it with you. So at that time it was quite common to pick up robe cloth from charnel grounds. Charnel grounds is a place where either the corpses just get chucked aside or they get burnt. That's what a charnel ground is. Not a very common thing to see these days, except if you go to certain countries in Asia, you still have charnel grounds. It's quite nice. You go to places like Wat Namachapi, where the monastery Ajahn Brahm started in Thailand, they have charnel grounds. You go there, the local villagers die, they build up a big stack of wood, and then they put the corpse on top and they burn it up. Yeah, it's quite amazing here. Yeah. If you did that here in Australia, you'd probably go to jail, so don't do it here. But some places you can still do these things. It's nice that society isn't so over-regulated sometimes. We live in this incredibly regulated societies. Things that actually are so useful in some ways, from a spiritual point of view, just as seeing a corpse burn might be very useful from a spiritual point of view, that's illegal. Yeah, it's actually, you wonder where the danger is, what is worse. Sometimes I think we may get things slightly wrong in our modern societies. Not just Australia, but large parts of the world are a bit like that, very sanitized, everything is out of view. Okay. So anyway, you find these rags, yeah, you find a rag on the roadside, and that rag, because it has been lying there for a long time, there will be parts of that rag that are nice, and parts of the rag that are terrible, that are rotted or whatever. So you spread it out, you press it down with your left foot, and you spread it out with the right foot. You get overview of this rag, you see which parts are good and which ones are no good. You take the person, you kind of take all the qualities of the person, you kind of see them in your mind's eye, good qualities, bad qualities, you spread it all around, so you have an overview of the qualities of that person. Same thing here. And then once you see what is good, then you tear off the good section. And what do you do with the bad section? You throw it away, because it's rubbish. You tear off the good section, you take it with you, you carry it in your little bag or little whatever it is that you have, you carry it with you, and you kind of secure it, because you know it will be valuable for future use, to patch up your robe, or maybe to even sew yourself a new robe in the future. Same way with those qualities of that person. Yeah, you see all the qualities in your mind's eye, you divide them up into good qualities and bad qualities, and then you take all those bad qualities and you throw them out, because they are rubbish. They are useless on the spiritual path. All they're going to do is lead you down the wrong track and lead you to ill will and problems and stop your meditation practice and all of these kind of things. So you check it out, and you take the good qualities of that person and you take them into your heart, and you carry them with you into the future. So they are there, they are available for you to be taken out whenever you need something to remind you of the good qualities of that person. So that is one way of doing that. You can do it quite formally. I know one of Ajahn Brahm's favorite kind of things to do, was kind of nice symbolic, is to write it down. All the bad qualities, you write them on toilet paper. Yeah. the good qualities, you take in really nice paper, yeah, beautiful paper with good qualities, and toilet paper for the bad ones. And when you have written all the bad qualities on the toilet paper, you take it to the toilet, chuck it in, and you flush it down. Has a kind of nice symbolic effect. Yeah, it's rubbish. It's no use. It's bad stuff. You throw it out. So that is this is the idea. And one of the interesting things about this, one of the kind of things that sometimes come up in this kind of situation, is people sometimes ask, but is this being realistic? Aren't we as Buddhists supposed to see things according to reality? If we deny the negative qualities and all we see is the good qualities, aren't we blinding ourselves to what is actually there? Aren't we kind of being stupid in a sense, not seeing things according to reality? And there's two ways to answer that, or two ways to kind of think about that. And one of them is that you don't necessarily have to not see the bad qualities. You can forgive them. Instead, you can have a sense of compassion for them for having those bad qualities in the first place. We'll come to that later on, because there are certain circumstances you can only have compassion if someone doesn't have any good qualities. So that is one way of dealing with it. Instead of blotting it out, you see them, but you have compassion for it. So you know that they are there. You have a whole picture of it. But there is another answer to this one, and that is the answer that it is not about seeing things as they actually are. Because when it comes to the qualities in other people, there is no reality. There is no truth. Two different people will look at the same person, and one will say they are wonderful, and the other person will say they are terrible. So which one is true? And of course, neither is true, because neither is just a particular view of the qualities of that person. Nobody really knows what the qualities are. It is uncertain. There isn't any reality as far as how we look at other people. People are changing all the time. They are moving. They may get up in the morning really grumpy, but by evening time they may be really smiley and happy. Which one is the real person? There isn't any reality there. They may be developing the spiritual path. One year they may not be so nice, the next year they may be much better. So which is the real one? There is no real person. There's nothing really to focus on. So because there is no reality in that realm, we have to ask a different question. And that is the question, what is the most useful thing to look for in terms of the spiritual path? That is the right question to ask. And the most useful thing is seeing the good qualities, because when we see the good qualities, we're actually developing the path, and we are moving in the right direction, and we are avoiding those defilements that is going to block us in the future. So we deliberately choose to look at certain qualities because we understand that there is no underlying reality anyway. Yeah, and if they have some really bad habits or bad qualities, we don't forget it completely because we don't want to be taken advantage of, but we forgive those instead. And then you are on the right track if you look at things in that way. And that is kind of the right way and the right answer to that. And that is a very useful thing to remember in life, this idea that we are always changing. We can never really compare anyone with anyone else. One of the problems in life, one of the reasons why we have so much wars in this world and so much violence and so much discrimination, all these things, is that we tend to be very tribal as human beings. This is my tribe. I have such and such a nationality, such and such a gender, such and such age, such and such education, such and such social standing, such and such country where I came from originally, and all of these things that kind of makes us into little tribes. And then the people who are not in my tribe, they are outside, and because they're outside, they are different from me. But actually, it's the wrong way of thinking about things. If there is no inherent essence inside of us, how can we really compare? If you are rich one day and the next day you are poor because you've invested your money stupidly or whatever. If you are smart at the beginning of life, but you become gradually more stupid as you get older, this happens. Yeah, sometimes people are smart one day and stupid the next one. I was reading somewhere that when you kind of lie down on the beach to get a tan, then if you do that this is what happens in a country like Norway, because it's such a cold country, everyone goes down to Spain and they kind of hang out on the beach for a couple of weeks. And when you come back to Norway after 2 weeks, you are much more stupid than when you went out. Yeah, because you're just lying on the beach being completely dumb for 2 weeks. When you come back, your brain is kind of deteriorated. You can't think anymore here. There was a study on that. So your IQ dropped dramatically in those 2 weeks. Everything is so uncertain. It's so unreliable. And especially if you take into account the idea of rebirth. Yeah. You move from one gender to the next one. You move from one nationality to the next one. You move from everything within the entire human history. You have been all of those positions. So which one are you? All of those places within human society that is possible to take, they are in you right now. They are there waiting to come out. Next life, who knows where you're going to get reborn. It's all inside you already. It has been there before. So how can you discriminate against anyone? How can you have this tribal mentality of one nation being different from another one? It's a beautiful way of thinking about the world and thinking about other people, because it takes away the sense of us being different and somehow inherently being separated by all of these markers that make us into give rise to these differences. And you start to see people, regardless of all these things, as basically the same as you, striving for the same things. And we all know that the core things of what it's like to be human are very much the same. Everyone striving to find more happiness in this world, getting away from suffering. Everyone having problems with similar kind of defilements of mind. So basically, those things, the kind of common things that makes us common human beings, they are pretty much the same things. And the other stuff is just superficial. And it's all inside of us waiting to come out. It's a wonderful way of thinking. And it makes you far more accepting of people, regardless of their situation in life. And it's something that we need in our world, because so much of that violence and problems arises from this perception that we are different. Usually it means we are better. That's usually what it means. Our civilization is older. Our civilization is better. We are smarter than they are. Whatever it is, that's usually what it comes down to. So you find something you are proud in. You're proud of your nationality. There's no need to be proud of your nationality. As soon as you're proud of your nationality, you're saying something about how your nation might be different from other. You should neither be proud nor not proud. You're just a human being. It's okay. There's no need to have a special pride in things. Once you become pride, you are taking it to be your ego. You're boosting up your sense of self. And it's not very useful. Anyway, getting a bit sidetracked. So this is the idea of looking at the good qualities in people. Seeing that and building that up, and then overcoming with wisdom power. Now you know roughly the meaning of wisdom power. What I mean when I say that is the idea of reflecting in a wise way, reflecting in a way that works to overcome these negative qualities. There you are. Let's go on to the next one. Next one is very similar, except the simile is a bit different. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here we have pretty much exactly the same as the previous one, except that the qualities are now different. Qualities are good and different qualities are bad. I don't think we need to worry too much about this distinction between verbal and bodily behavior. Maybe we should. I'm not sure. I never really figured out whether we should or not. I think the main point is just that there is some good qualities and some bad ones. And in this case, they are different. So we need a bit of flexibility in our perceptions to kind of move around with what kind of works in this kind of perception. But the main thing here is the simile. The simile, the pond covered with algae and water plants. The pond is like the person. And the algae and water plants are like some of the negative qualities in that person. So it's covered with that. You see those on the outside, yeah, and you don't see fully what is there. Yeah? Then this person comes afflicted and oppressed by the heat. This means like you're angry, yeah, oppressed by this hot heat inside. You are weary because angry makes you tired, so you're kind of weary. But you're also thirsty. It's like you're looking for that solution. You're looking for something to get out of that angry. Thirsty and parched. Parched like hot, slightly sunburnt or whatever. And then the way, what you do then is that when you come to this person, this pond, you sweep away the algae and water plants. You sweep away those bad qualities. You know that they are rubbish. You know that they are bad. And underneath those water plants and bad qualities, you find the beautiful clear water. And you drink it up. You drink up those good qualities of the other person. And of course, when you drink it up, you carry them with you into the future. And you bring it with you. And because you carry them with you and they are close to your heart, it means that they're easy to take, bring out again later on and remember. So you cool down, yeah, with cool water, seeing the good qualities. It's a nice symbolism of cooling down there, not being angry. And that is how you get rid of that that anger. So again, quite nice similes that make it kind of very clear what is going on here. You drink on board the good qualities of the person. Let's go to the third one. How, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind? Suppose there is a little water in a puddle, then a man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir up, disturb it, make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and depart. He then gets down on all fours, sucks it up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, placidity of the mind he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment should be removed towards that person. So here we have a person who does not have many good qualities, yeah, bad bodily actions, bad speech, and I'm sure you know some of those people, they are around, but he has a little bit of good qualities, and this little bit of good qualities here is called the opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, the chittasa vivarana. Vivarana is the opposite of nivarana. Nivarana means hindrance. Five hindrances are nivarana. And the opposite of that is the vivarana. This is how the Pali often works. You have a slightly different prefix to the word, and it makes it the opposite meaning. So an opening of the mind really means the mind without hindrances, the mind that is pure, the mind that you get in meditation sometimes when you become peaceful and nice and maybe you experience joy and that sort of stuff. The more you have of that, the more vivarana, the more open your mind is, the less it is kind of hemmed in by these defilements. And placidity of the mind, chittang pasidati. Pasidati is this beautiful word you find in the suttas that means like being confident and calm and placid. Placid is like a water that is placid, it's like flat. Yeah, it's not ruffled, it is calm and flat instead, the surface of the water. So placid, mind is placid, pasidati, very nice word that you see throughout the suttas, one of the qualities of a wholesome mental state. So in this case, you look for that, you look for this tiny bit of good qualities, and you don't look at the bad qualities. And the simile in this case, because there's only a tiny bit of good qualities, you have to be very careful when you look at those good qualities. Because if you're not careful, you're going to disturb it up. If you look a little bit too far to the left or to the right, you will see the bad qualities. So you have to have a laser-like focus on those good qualities. And have this kind of very evocative simile of being like a cow. So you have to be like a cow, yeah? Get down on all fours and suck up those good qualities. And then you're doing it in the right way here. Yeah? So remember to be like a cow in your practice. Not in all ways, but in some ways to be like a cow. Huh? So this is how you do that. And what is interesting about this is how far the Buddha says we should go in this idea of practicing metta. These first three ways of dealing with unwholesome or resentment, unwholesome qualities or resentment, they are all about focusing on metta. Yes, seeing the good qualities in other people is all about metta practice. It is distinguished from karuna, karuna being compassion. The distinction is that when you do karuna, you are really focusing on the suffering in others, and you're wishing them well because you don't want other people to suffer. That is also a very beautiful quality, but it is distinguished from metta, which really is just a straight out focus on the good qualities. What is interesting about this is the degree to which the Buddha says we should kind of use metta before we use karuna. And the reason for this, and this is something you see throughout the suttas, when you see the list of the four Brahma Viharas, the four divine abidings, they always come in the same sequence. Always metta first, karuna is second, mudita is the third. Mudita is often translated as sympathetic joy. When you rejoice in other people's success, is the opposite of schadenfreude. Schadenfreude is this German word that means you rejoice in other people's lack of success or misery. Yeah, it's one of those really kind of mean states. I don't know. In English now, they use this word a lot. I don't know why. Whether maybe they, I'm not sure what is going on there. Some kind of cultural transfer from German to English or something. I don't know what's happening. Anyway, so you instead of having schadenfreude, you have the exact opposite. You have rejoice in other people's success and good qualities. And then the last one is upekkha, which is equanimity, which is the most difficult of all four because it is the mind developed to the highest possible point. But metta is always first. And when you look at the suttas that speak about the Brahma Viharas, metta is the one that is talked about the most often in those suttas. The other day we talked about some of those suttas, the Kosambya Sutta, Buddha talks about metta, about body, speech and mind. You have the Metta Sutta, which is about metta. You have the simile of the saw, which is about metta. Have metta, even if you are cut apart limb by limb by a two-handled saw, you should have metta towards those people who assail you. And if you don't do that, the Buddha says, you're not practicing my teaching. That's a really high bar to clear. But the point is, it can be cleared. Yeah, that's kind of the point. If you move in that direction, you will clear it. So why is it that metta is always emphasized in this way more than karuna? And I think the answer is that metta is generally easier. You cannot really go wrong with metta. If you have metta, there aren't any bad side effects to it. Seeing the good qualities in others is just positive. It just makes you happy. It just makes you kind of feel joy and etc. If it works for you. But karuna actually can be more dangerous because with karuna you're focusing on the negative qualities. Sometimes you can get a bit depressed. Yeah, you see all the negative qualities. Unless you are skilled with it and you do it in the right way, it can kind of have a negative side effect to it. And I've heard of many examples of people who are practicing just karuna and who after a while lose all the energy. They lose everything because it's just too much. It's like taking on all the burdens in the world, and after a while it just depletes you completely and they become incapable of any kind of practice at all. So it takes a bit more skill to do karuna properly. I think this is the why the Buddha says this in this way. This doesn't mean that you shouldn't do karuna. Sometimes the only thing you can do is karuna, and we will see this afterwards. But it means you have to be a little bit more careful and just reflect on the effects it has on you and whether it gives the right results or not. If it gives the right results, no problem. I think regardless, the metta part is a very important and crucial. So this is why I think this is the sequence here. So you focus on those qualities. You can see here it's kind of a little bit strange because you focus on mental qualities rather than bodily and verbal qualities. But of course, we can all read other people's minds, so there's no problem there. Huh? It's true. Actually, it's true. We all read each other's minds all the time. One of those interesting little things, we normally think that reading minds is kind of getting inside someone's head and seeing what's going on there. But in the suttas, they talk about mind reading. The first way to read mind is just to look at someone, look at their body language straight away. You know where their mind state is at. We do this all the time. Yeah, we say, oh, this person is angry. They haven't even uttered a word. We just know straight away from the way they are. We are basically reading their mind. Yeah, so to a large extent, we are mind readers all the time. So we do actually. The mind is not that. You can't really hide your mental states that much. Sometimes you can, but not always. And so in that sense, we are all mind readers to a large extent. And you can feel when someone is really peaceful or really kind and all these things. If you are alert and aware and wise, you can see these things. So that is how we can know that, know these things. So anyway, that is all about metta practice. And now we come to the case of someone where we cannot have metta and we have to have karuna because there are no good qualities to be seen. And this is what happens in this case. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure and who does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind from time to time? Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind them and the next village ahead of them were both far away. They would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. They would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May they get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this person does not encounter calamity and disaster right here. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and they do not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for them, thinking, oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May they abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May they abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body after death, they will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So this is the case where you cannot see the good qualities. Yeah, you look at this person, maybe you have a long bad history with them or whatever, and you cannot see any good qualities. And then you have to have a different strategy. You cannot have metta anymore, because the metta becomes impossible when there's nothing to focus on that gives rise to metta. You need a different strategy to deal with a person like that. Now the first thing to remember about this is that when you don't see any good qualities in another person, it doesn't mean they haven't got any good qualities. It just means that you can't see them, and these are two different things. Again, we can never really know other people fully. Another person might come along and see lots of good qualities in that person, but you can't see them. And because you can't see them, for you the practice has to be karuna. Yeah, so there's a number of wonderful things that comes from that way of looking at people, rather than judging people once and for all as bad or anything like that. You have a much more open mind. You allow people to grow. You allow people to change. You allow yourself to grow, so that your perception of other people changes. And it means that down the track you may be able to have metta towards them instead of having karuna. So you're opening up the world in a different way. You understand the changeability of the world, and you don't make harsh judgments. So that is the first. It's very beneficial for oneself to do that. But the second thing, which also is very good about that, it is actually an act of kindness towards the other person. It is always very harsh to judge people completely. If you judge people absolutely and you say that they are a bad person, you often don't give them a chance to kind of change and to become someone else. It means that, and very often when other people feel judged, very often they tend to live up to that judgment. So you see them as bad and they kind of become bad, they become that person that you are looking at the point of view you have towards them. Yeah, because people somehow, they react to the circumstances around them. But the opposite is true. If you are kind and caring to them and you do your very best to see the good qualities, very often they live up to that because they know that you are seeing good qualities in them and they want to live up to that. And they become better people simply because you are focusing on the good qualities. It's amazing how these little things actually have such an important impact. So by looking at the good qualities in others, always trying to see them, by having compassion instead of ill will when someone has a difficult time, and not judging people too harshly, it is actually a gift to other people. You are allowing them to develop out of that bad situation and to become better people by doing things in this way. So please don't be too judgmental in the world. It's one of the things that I have found that I always regret when I get too judgmental. I always regret it afterwards, because afterwards I always see a different side of that person. And I think I was too harsh. Why am I being so harsh with other people? And I think this is very often how we feel after being judgmental. We often realize in retrospect we're being too harsh of others. So this is a very nice and simple thing that comes as a result of this. Know that it is only your perception at that time, and that it will change in the future. And this is just the way of the world. So the next thing is then, well, how does this work? What does it mean, this idea of here having having compassion for this person? What it means, you can see here, is that you realize basically that this person is ill, they are afflicted, they are moving towards tremendous suffering, even death right there on the as they are traveling along that highway. Why are they moving towards their death? Because they being sick here is like having all these bad qualities. Yeah, the village being far away means that there is nobody you can talk to and who you can consult with. There's no leader of the village district. That's like the Buddha. He's the leader of the village district. He's someone who can guide you in the right direction. There is no medicine or qualified attendant. Like the Dhamma and your Kalyanamittas, they are like the medicine and qualified attendant. All of that is missing. So you're moving towards your own destruction, your own death, and a terrible kind of future. That, of course, is exactly the same thing if people have bad qualities. When you see only bad qualities, if you are right about that, and you have to assume you're right, otherwise you would be seeing the good qualities in them, so you have to assume that you're right about those negative qualities. Actually, that person is heading towards a terrible future because of all those bad qualities. They are already probably very miserable in the life they have now, because if you treat other people badly, generally speaking, you don't feel very good about yourself. But far worse is where you're heading after you pass away in the future, because you're building up negative mental qualities. Your death comes, you judge yourself badly, and basically you think you deserve to go to a bad destination afterwards. And this is how you throw yourself into this bad destination, and you suffer enormously as a consequence. So once you see this in another person, once you see that everybody in this world, everybody wants to be happy, but here is someone who is practicing for their own suffering. They want to be happy just like everyone else. They think that what they're doing is going to give them happiness. Everybody thinks that, even the most horrendous crimes, people do it because they think it's right on some level, otherwise they wouldn't do it. So they think they're doing something which is good. Well, actually, they're doing something that only leads to their own suffering. They are their own worst enemy. Yeah, they're acting like their own worst enemy. They're creating suffering for themselves in the future. They are blind, basically. They're walking in the darkness. They have no idea what they're doing. So how can you feel about a person like that, who is so blind, who is walking in the darkness, who has turned the world upside down, who doesn't know the power of kindness? I think most of us, we know the power of kindness in one way. And somehow these people have got themselves deluded into a very deep, terrible state of mind. The only natural right response is to have compassion for them, because they have no idea what's going on. Sometimes you have to bear the brunt of other people's bad behavior, and often you feel sorry for yourself, and that's why you get angry. Why are they doing this towards me? I don't deserve this, I haven't done anything bad, and you get upset with them. But remember that the person who is really suffering is not you. It is the other person, the one who is behaving this way. They are the ones who are really suffering, and who will suffer in the future. You just have to hang out with that person for a few minutes, then you walk away and you do your own thing. Yeah, and it's all over. They have to be with themselves all the time, and they are creating this very terrible state inside. And there's something very beautiful about this, because instead of focusing on yourself and being selfish and being self-focused, is always a very small kind of mind state. When you're focusing on yourself, it is like you against the world. The world is scary when you are in your shell, little shell, and you become defensive against the world outside. That is what selfishness feels like. Self-focus, what it feels like, it's you against the world. But when you turn the table and instead you become compassionate, you're opening up yourself up, you're taking in other people in your heart, so to speak, and because you're doing that, you have this expansive feeling of the world. The world doesn't seem frightening anymore. Even if other people are bad, it doesn't seem so frightening, because you still are able to see those other people in a good way by having compassion towards them. So it's actually a very beautiful thing that happens there, moving away from self-centeredness and self-concern towards concern for all the beings in the world, and seeing their weaknesses and seeing their troubles. It's a wonderful little trick of the mind again, just to expand your horizons, expand your mind, and making you build up these spiritual qualities that will be so useful on the spiritual path. That is what this is about. So remember that, yeah. So the next time when somebody is treating you in a way that may not be so nice, look at that person a different way. Understand that the problem is not yours. It is not you against them. It feels personal, and that's why we get angry. It feels like they are attacking you or attacking me. How can you attack me? What have I done? I've done nothing. Don't talk to me like that. I deserve better. Don't think like that. It's got nothing to do with you. It's never personal. It is the other person. They are just playing out their conditioning, playing out their inner robot program. Yeah, and now it's playing out. You happen to be at the receiving end of their stupidity and their delusion. But it's not really nothing to do with you. It's got everything to do with them. And once you get that it's got nothing to do with you, you don't get upset anymore. Because you can just shrug your shoulders. Okay, it's your problem. Yeah, and then you can forgive, and you can let go, and you can look at those people in a different way. It doesn't mean that you put yourself in harm's way. You don't put yourself, you still understand the limits of being around people like that. So you still kind of stay away from them a little bit if it gets too much for you. And you pull back a little bit. You always look after yourself. It doesn't mean you become compassionate in a stupid way and kind of make life difficult for yourself. It just means that when these situations occur, because they will always occur, it's impossible to always have a perfect relationship with everyone around you. That is when you use this kind of technique. So this is, for those of questions I had before about going into more detail about how to use the wisdom, this is what we're talking about, these things we're talking about now. And these things are incredibly powerful techniques. If you can learn to look at people in this way, then after a while it gets quite difficult to get angry with people. Instead you're seeing this robot playing out the program inside, someone who's not really able to be any different. But also don't get conceited about it. Don't think that you are better. That's kind of sometimes another question that comes up in these situations. People say, but if I think like that, it makes me feel really, I'm good. They're really bad or whatever. But that is also not right. Because remember that we are always changing. Before you know it, you are the one who is bad and the other person is the good one. In the past life it might be exact opposite. In the next life it may be the opposite again. Later on next year maybe it is the opposite. We should never judge just because someone is deluded. It doesn't mean you should feel any better, because it is not inherent to that person. Next time you are the deluded person. So you treat them with compassion, but you don't look down upon them. You're not condescending. You're not kind of have a sense of superiority about you. So that is also wrong. So yeah, it's quite tricky. You have to get all these factors together, and then it starts to work. Don't be a perfectionist. Don't think that this is going to work every time. It's going to take a while. If you don't get it, don't judge yourself badly either. Have compassion for yourself. Know that your own conditioning is very deep. It takes a long time to recondition the mind. But just plug away at it. And one day, gradually, this change will occur inside of you. And you start to become a different person. And then you deal with the world in a far better way. And you become much more even. And you flow through life in this even way. And then life becomes so much more bearable. And you are on that beautiful eightfold path, practicing in the right way. Okay. Last person. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure and who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind? So here we have the person who is good in all ways. Yeah, no problems there. Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean with smooth banks and a delightful place shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink, and then after coming out, he would sit or lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should attend to the pure bodily behavior, to the pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of the mind, the placidity of the mind, they gain from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here you are angry, yeah, with this person, even though they have all good qualities. And this is what I mean, this is kind of, sometimes we are just irrational, or we are just running with our own program, our own defilements. Sometimes it's got nothing to do with what the other person is like. So here you have the saint, you have the saint who only has good qualities. So when you come to them, when you are angry, there's no algae and water plants to be kind of gotten rid of. All we have to do is just bathe, jump, dive into that pond, yeah, head first, and then bathe and drink and kind of, whoa, cool down so quickly, so easily, and take on board all those good qualities. And then what is kind of the interesting thing about this one is that then afterwards, because it's such a delightful little oasis with all these beautiful trees around, you lie down right there in the shade of those trees, not going too far away from that pond, because that pond is such a wonderful place to be. You hang around that person, yeah, someone who has all good qualities. They are probably worthy of being taken as a teacher, especially if you are the angry one, as in this case. Probably take them as a teacher. It's like the Buddha, yeah, it's like the Buddha that is talked about here, or maybe an arahant, or someone else who is practicing really well, and you become the disciple of that person, and you hang around, you stay around in the shade of those trees. It's like when you hang around in the shade of a really good person, you feel better about yourself as well, yeah, because you are hanging out with other good people. It affects you in a positive way. So this is really, this is interesting, and a different approach. And then it says at the very last line there, it says, friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence or inspiration, this placidity again, this word, inspiration, confidence, faith, yeah? All of these things kind of combined into one idea. So when you finally find someone who is has the right qualities, you hang around them. You don't leave. You go to visit them regularly. You hear the Dhamma. And as you hang around them and you hear the Dhamma, gradually confidence and faith builds up. You have found a Kalyanamitta. Kalyanamitta is the root root good on the Noble Eightfold Path, because without that you cannot actually get anywhere in your practice. Without the Karanamitta you are stuck in samsara, stuck in suffering. So here you have finally found something, you cling on, yeah, you don't allow yourself to go. And when this Arahant says go away, you say no way, I'm staying here. So sometimes you've got to be stubborn about things, yeah, that's okay. So that is the good person in this world. And it's interesting the way the Buddha, and we will see this actually, I think actually coming up in a sutta just further down, how the Buddha says that it is beneficial. Just seeing an Arahant in the world is so beneficial, because you see that possibility, yeah? Your mind gains confidence because you see the possibility of something else. You see that development of the mind, you see the human potential, you see it before your very eyes. You're reading the mind of that Arahant right there. That's what you're doing really, because you're seeing what is going on in someone else. So just seeing somebody like that is already very, very beneficial. So then you hang around and you allow yourself to be influenced, to be brainwashed by that person. These friends are the five ways of removing resentment, by means of which a bhikkhu can entirely remove resentment towards whoever it has arisen. There you are. And so remember to focus on the good quality in people if you can. And if you can't, then you have compassion. And remember one of the similes that I like to use, and I learned this from Ajahn Brahm originally. So much of what I know is just straight from Ajahn Brahm. I'm just regurgitating what I've learned over the past 25 years. Robot, yeah, this is a real robot. This is kind of the things you realize after a while. And Ajahn Brahm was always the one with the simile of the red light. Yeah, and this is the kind of which works with the compassion idea here. The simile of the red light. When you come in your car, you're in a hurry and the light goes red. And either you can just say, okay, you get a bit upset because the light goes red, but it doesn't go very deeply. Or you can get really, really angry with that red light. Get out of your car. Go up and shake, give that red light a good shake. You evil red light. You knew I was coming around the corner. You knew I was in a hurry. And then, of course, you get locked up in an asylum soon afterwards. So the point is that red lights, they are just circuits. They are just a program working itself out. And because of that, you don't get so incredibly angry with red light. You might get a bit frustrated or whatever, but you don't go over the top. Human beings, they are like red lights. They are driven by the conditioning from the past. It feels like we are autonomous. It feels like we're making decisions. And that is why it is so hard to realize that we are like red lights, because the feeling is so different. But actually, from Buddha's point of view, that feeling is an illusion. That is such an important part of the illusion of the self. Take that illusion out of the equation, and you start to understand how conditioned we are. And then you can start to forgive. Once you see people as red light, you don't get so angry anymore. You forgive them instead. You understand that their suffering is caused by their conditioning, and they can't find a way out. Then you really start to have compassion for the world. Just a little bit like the Buddha had compassion for the world after his awakening. He saw the suffering. He saw people being desperate to get out of it, but not seeing the way out. He had people being blind, not finding the way out. Compassion arose, and he gave us these teachings that we still have 2,500 years later. So we try to be a little bit more like the Buddha in that sense. And then it is just so useful and so powerful for our own practice. Okay, that is all for this afternoon. We'll see you back again at 7:30 this evening.